The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, your number one news and talk station.
The Money Show brought to you by the Old Mutual Investment Group. Invest where the fund managers invest. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. I hope you've had a good day. I hope you've had a productive day. I hope nobody's wasted your time. There we are. Subtweet. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. And we got lots coming up for you this evening, including why you would want to own property in a world where owning property is increasingly expensive. It's increasingly onerous. The paperwork is time-consuming when you buy and sell property. The taxes involved in buying and selling property are extreme and could get worse if new proposals that the Davis Tax Committee is considering are accepted, because they'll be seen as an asset and as a wealth tax, so then you could target property. So then everybody will rent property. But from whom will you rent if nobody owns the property? We'll talk about the science of property rentals later on. Lots of people espouse this as a much better idea than owning very costly assets, especially if you're one of those sorts of people or one of those sorts of families that likes to move house from time to time. But property is a base for many people upon which to build wealth. And one of the great ideas of South Africa in the 21st century is that if people are living in council housing, if people are living in tribal trust land, perhaps they should be given title deeds to that land to have a tradable asset, an asset upon which to build wealth. So let's talk about property rentals this evening versus property ownership. I'm looking forward to that conversation coming up later on tonight. Our Africa Business Report, there's been a resurgence in Somali piracy, which is concerning. Andy Rice with Heroes and Zeros, looking forward to his snippy insights as to what's going on in the world of marketing. SAA warning today that it could face strike action tomorrow. One of the trade unions, which represents its cabin crew, threatening to go on strike. We'll touch on that this evening. Clyde, if you're around, give us a shout, please, on 011-883-0702, or you can call us, along with everybody else, on 021-446-0567. We'll look at the issue of growth, or is that an issue of no growth, and today's extraordinary activity on markets. All of that is coming up on tonight's edition of The Money Show.
Money Show. Bruce is on Twitter, at Bruce Business.
I don't want to be too melodramatic about this, but a story today made us wonder whether or not South Africa has given up on trying to get any kind of economic growth. We were headed this year, before Pravin Gordhan got fired, to growth of maybe even 2% if the die fell our way. Now, subsequent to Pravin Gordhan sacking and the downgrade of South Africa's debt by Fitch and a partial downgrade by Standard & Poor's or S&P Global, we face growth, if we're lucky, of 1% this year. So virtually stagnant, a bit like last year was. We know that last year was a tough year. So have we given up on trying to generate the kind of policy that is going to get us growth? Because growth, after all, is a factor of policy choices. More and more of our policy, though, seems to be pushing us towards a more distributive model of a greater and greater proportion of wealth being seen to be distributed rather than the creation of new wealth. And an opinion piece today, 10 days ago, by the finance minister's advisor, Chris Malekane, the prof from WITS, didn't mention growth once in 1,400 words and was intent on nationalization of everything from lands to banks to insurers to mines. So where is growth going to come from? Is growth even relevant anymore? Reports today saying the finance ministry has asked for a study into the introduction of an annual wealth tax, a request via the Davis Tax Committee, which makes recommendations to the National Treasury, also requested submissions from the public, that's you and me, on the feasibility of a land tax and a national tax on the value of property in addition to the existing charges, already onerous charges, of owning property. It's all part of this radical economic transformation mantra. The move comes 2 months after government increased the top tax bracket to 45%, of course, and President Jacob Zuma called for radical economic transformation. We're getting a better idea, I suppose, as the days go by as to what it means to different people, but we're yet to get a single definitive example. Lumkile Mondi, senior lecturer at the School of Economics and Business Science at WITS University. Has South Africa, Lumkile, given up on growth? It certainly feels like it.
It feels like it, Bruce. Bruce, remember that one of the brilliant stories about South Africa's economic development is the fact that in the 60s, between 1960 and 1973, were an amazing period of growth where even the apartheid regime, which barred blacks from playing a particular role at manufacturing, that business absorb those blacks in terms of ensuring that they sustain those growth levels. Also, if you look at the period between 2001 and 2008, similar story, and the importance of the growth story of South Africa's economic development is that it's always been labor absorptive. Not only did it create wealth for investors, but also it managed us to invest in new areas for development. So it's quite surprising that South Africa is now looking at redistributive policies and spending less time on growth, where in fact many countries are focusing on new areas of economic development into the fourth industrial revolution. And therefore, if we look at ourselves, if we go in this redistributive rhetoric that is so dominant today, we're going to find ourselves lagging far behind than where we were in 1994 when the democratic states took control of our country.
There's a risk of going back to the 1960s and saying that those were the glory days of the South African economy. But that was the time that the lager was sort of closing in on South Africa. Apartheid was declared in that decade by the United Nations as a crime against humanity. More and more sanctions were being applied against South Africa. And South Africa was developing its own capacity to have an independent economy. And it was under Verwoerd, I think, that the economy peaked at 8.9% in 1 year, 1965. And through that decade, you mentioned, growth was over 6%. And that was the time of investing heavily in state-owned enterprises, developing the likes of Arms Corps and Sasol and others. Do we need to go back to those sorts of days, Lumkile, or do we need a complete rethink on the economics to get back to sort of the growth phase that can absorb labor and create opportunities for more South Africans?
Bruce, you and a number of South Africans in our broader society got involved in a very consultative process over 4 years ago in formulating a plan called the National Development Plan, where you understood very clearly what needed to be done. So there is a strategy that is growth orientated. Not only growth orientated, but there's elements of redistribution, of creating capability, of really investing in key economic infrastructure to change the landscape and have inclusivity in our society. So we have a state that, since 2009, that adopted a national policy action plan, adopted a new growth path, and promised over a million jobs by 2019. And it's failing dismally. Not only is it failing dismally, it's losing quite a lot of popular support, but not in areas where it's predominantly are black areas. So we are seeing really a fear that that we've seen in countries like Venezuela and countries like Zimbabwe and Zambia, where these liberation movements, that when they're in power and they're failing their own people, get seduced to populist policies, and in our case, blame whites in pursuit of economic power, of political power, rather than economic success, because it's only true economic success when you can bring a number of black people that are marginalized in society that have seen a job since 1994.
Lukile, I'm not sure if your hand has slipped over the mouthpiece of your phone, but you've suddenly gone very muffled, a bit like that.
There we go.
That's better. Yeah. Now we got you. Lukile, but finally, I mean, rhetoric is a lot easier. It takes no effort relative to the National Development Plan, which is a big, challenging, complex set of values designed to get us to a more equitable future over time. It's not popular, it's not populist, and that's why I guess it's been it's gone to the same file as every other great economic plan that has been put on the table in South Africa over the last 20 years.
Well, Bruce, the challenge now is for me, you, and many others, are those who are committed to a South Africa that is inclusive, that is focusing on long term, that is able to redress and grow business, while at the same time integrating a lot of the marginalized, the poor. That strategy doesn't rest on radical economic transformation. It rests on all of us who know and understand that through a pivotal engagement, what Bantulo Misa is talking about, an economic Odessa, where we formulate a strategy that's inclusive. You cannot succeed in a country that is class-based, that is racial-based. We need all of us to recognize that this economy can only grow. And it's not going to grow by high taxes, such as wealth tax or any other form of tax. is going to grow because of business leadership, government leadership, as well as society leadership, take control of it, and we all work together to that achievement of a growth that's inclusive and redistributive, so South Africa can take its own position in the world.
Nkile Mondi, always thoughtful. Thank you. Senior lecturer at the School of Economics and Business Science at Wits University. Gerard in Pretoria, you've got a SARS problem. Hello.
Hi, Bruce. Yes, I'm just calling with regards to the investigation that's currently happening with the Ombudsman and SARS. And we are an export company in Pretoria North, and at the moment, SARS owes us more than 10.5 million rand worth of VAT returns. And all that they're doing is they're raising a VAT audit on our returns, and before the 21 days are over, they just raise a new VAT audit on our new VAT return. It all gets batched into one group, and they don't pay us out. And this has put us in a situation where we have had to loan money from the bank just to keep afloat. And at the moment, we can't keep on going like this because we'll have to let go of 200 people. We've got a charity that we support, more than 80 underprivileged families in the Pretoria North area. And we just want to hear if there's anyone that can give us advice on what
have you been to the tax ombud, Gerard? Have you taken this issue to Judge Bernard Ngwepe?
Yes, this is not the first time it happened. Last year it also happened where they owed us 4.8 million rand. We went to the ombudsman and it got resolved. But at the moment, the ombudsman is unable to help us because it's still in the 21 days working period. So they're just flagging each audit and grouping them together and just refusing to pay it out. It's just a delay tactic from their side.
Thank you, Gerard. I'm sorry that you're struggling. And SARS, if you're listening and if you can help, you might want to give us a call and see whether or not you can facilitate that particular VAT refund, because it's that kind of bureaucratic intransigence which can lead to the collapse of a business, collapse of 200 jobs, collapse of supporting businesses that support Gerard's business. Cecile, please will you take Gerard's details? And if SARS can help, that'll be awesome. Tladi, spokesperson for SAA, a warning from you this evening, Tladi, that there could be strike action. One of the trade unions that represents cabin crew threatening to go on strike tomorrow for the day, is it?
Good evening, Bruce, and good evening to our listeners. Indeed, that is the situation that is facing us at the moment. And we felt that it was a necessary step to take on our part to advise our passengers of a possible industrial action. We don't know if this will actualize tomorrow or parties might be able to find one another and there might be a resolution or a settlement on the matter.
How long has this been brewing for, Tladi?
This is a matter that was raised last year by the union, where they presented their demands to us, and then we had to follow processes that are provided for in terms of the agreement that manages relationship between the employer and labor, and parties could not find each other. One must indicate that out of the recognized unions that operate at SAA, this is the one union that has decided that they want to stand their ground on this matter. We are not for a moment suggesting that their concerns are not legitimate, but we feel that there are certain things that we need to take care of in order to keep the business afloat before we could attend to the matters that they raise.
Which union is it? How big is it relative to the number of cabin crew that are employed by SAA?
The union is South African Cabin Crew Association, which really has a lion's share of membership in South Africa.
Okay, so this is serious.
Cabin crew members are concerned. I beg your pardon?
So this is serious.
We are from a numbers point of view, and if you look at what union is really speaking out loud on this matter, you could say so. But insofar as what will translate into reality or practice, it is something that that remains to be seen. We are comforted by the fact that notwithstanding that there has not been any agreement on the matter, there's willingness on their part to continue to meet with us. We have met with them yesterday, including today, and we are not ruling out a possibility that we might have a deal even in the last minute.
So how do your passengers do tomorrow morning, Tladi? Do they bother going to the airport? Do they wait at home? Will you phone each passenger individually and say, your flight is going, your flight's not going? How will it work?
We are going to communicate with all the passengers whom we have their contact details, and that will be a direct communication if we have their cell phone numbers or their email addresses. However, we are also going to make use of partners like yourself, you know, traditional or mainstream media, also including the use of our official communication channels.
But just look out for SAA communication on this. It could go bad. It could be a perfectly normal day. I mean, at this stage, it's up in the air, so to speak.
Absolutely. It's up in the air at the moment, and I encourage our customers to keep in touch with us through our communication channels, including our website and our call center numbers.
Tadi, thank you. Spokesperson for SAA. Possible strike action tomorrow. The biggest trade union in the cabin crew, amongst cabin crew, threatening to go on strike. If they do go on strike, you can expect big delays tomorrow on the eve of what for many people is a long weekend.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Wayne McCurry with Ashburton Investments. It's nice to see rises on U.S. stock markets because news is good, because company profits are improving, because the outlook for those companies is improving, and not on the hope, the phantom hope, that some politician is going to improve the performance of the economy by himself.
Quite correct, Bruce. I mean, certainly in the earnings season, the earnings that have come through have been quite good. And of course, you know, Trump is going to, I think very soon now, going to issue his tax proposals. At least we'll have some certainty on that. But make no mistake, the U.S. economy was growing long before Trump came along. Just a couple of his proposals did clearly boost the share market, you know, post his election as president.
Yeah, I mean, they did, and they boosted the share market. But now what we're seeing is these good results coming through and companies rallying very, very nicely. The Nasdaq, we only remember the Nasdaq because when it collapsed in 1999, it felt like the world was ending. But it's hit the 6,000 level for the first time. And I know it's just a number, but it's big and it's round, and it's the highest level ever.
Yeah, no, it is. Look, Bruce, it was 2002 and it collapsed, not 1999. I remember it well. And I think the height on the Nasdaq there was about 4,500 to 5,500, and it just disappeared in front of your eyes. But yes, certainly it has gone. And of course, the whole environment has changed, you know, but the Nasdaq still obviously favors the tech-heavy type of companies, and clearly they've been a lot more successful this time around than in the dot-com boom.
True. So the likes of Tesla are in there, and those sorts of real technology companies that actually do real things rather than create websites in the belief that somehow they'll make money, and they never did.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's a bit of good news. But there are concerns. I mean, and you would have seen many of these concerns come and go over the years, Wayne McCurry, but concerns and social media are flutter with all kinds of concerns of bubbles developing and real concerns that markets are overheating. Are you feeling that?
Look, Bruce, the markets aren't particularly cheap, but I don't think that they're overheating at all. Another boost to the markets just very recently was the fallback in the U.S. long bond from about 2.5 down to 2.2. That also will give a boost to the market. In fact, the biggest bubble has already burst, and people have sort of almost gone unnoticed, and that was the bond market bubble in developed economies. I mean, you've taken a serious beating in your capital return in the last, about a year or so, on German bonds, on U.S. bonds, because in the U.S. in particular, you know, it went up from 1.5 to 2.5, now back to 2.2. That's a big capital loss on a long-term bond. Sure. Other bubbles developing. Look, it's so easy to spot a bubble after it's burst, by the way. It's not always easy to spot it before it bursts. But normally a bubble will be preceded by a massive expansion of debt in that particular sector. There's people borrowing money to invest into that sector, and some immediately apparent investment area that is just the best thing since sliced bread, that every single person is, that's the only thing they ever talk about. Now, there might be something like that in Tesla. There might be something like that right now in emerging markets, but I certainly don't see any immediately apparent bubble. But as I said, they're hard to spot beforehand.
Completely. I mean, it builds up to the final question, really, which is we've saw immediately after Pravin Gordhan got fired, we saw a pullback in locally focused companies, anticipation of ratings downgrades and the disastrous consequences that would immediately accompany that. That hasn't occurred,
no.
And what we've seen is the bond market actually being well supported, as you explained last week, and we've seen the share prices of many of the companies that were sold down so sharply on fear rise on, I don't know what, optimism, ignorance, I'm not sure, but banks are back,
yes.
Local retailers are back, and it's as if there is no threat of a real full-blown dump.
Yeah, make no mistake, junk status, full junk status is devastating. Make no mistake about that. But obviously the market, and this is not locals, it's foreigners. Eh? Yeah. Obviously foreigners accept the risk and they still like the yield and they're back here. So the shares and banking shares, etc., have only really rallied because the rand's been stable. If the rand was 14.50, the domestic shares and the banking shares would not be rallying. They would still be at those depressed levels. But it's not. It's, what, 13.10? In fact, it went below 13 yesterday.
Yeah.
So there has clearly been remarkable resilience in the rand stroke bonds, because essentially they're almost one unit in a case like this. And then the accompanying rally in the banking shares and other SA-focused shares.
And that'll continue for as long as the rand remains relatively strong. The rand
Correct.
Will remain relatively strong for as long as money flows into the bond market. Money will continue to flow into the bond market for as long as we remain investment grade.
Yes.
That is the tipping point.
That certainly is. But look, I mean, it's almost disappointing that the rand hasn't collapsed more, because that's what you would expect it to do. But obviously it's good news that it hasn't done that. And it is foreigners that are coming in simply because you can get a very good yield here, despite all the risks in relation to what you can get overseas. And irrespective of the actual junk status, you know, we're not imminently going to default on the government paying back debt. There's not an imminent default on that, not by a long margin.
Wayne McCurry, thank you, with Ashburton Investments on The Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, your number one news and talk station.
She may have been the Liberty Radio Awards newsreader of the year, but Tara Penny is of absolutely no use to me, so I've had to do my own research on the weather in Omaha, Nebraska. This time next week, mid to higher teens in terms of degrees Celsius. Partly cloudy, bit of sunshine. That's good. That's good. Oh, it gets up to nearly 20 degrees by Saturday, May the 6th, at the Warren Buffett Annual General Meeting. Why would I care about... Oh, that's because I'm going. I'm going to talk to a guy who's coming along with me just after after sport in just a moment. So we'll do that. Talk about Warren Buffett. Talk about the visit that we're undertaking to the place where it's about 18 or 19 degrees this time next week, which is better than I think Warren Ingram had last year. Last year, he was shivering and quivering. You could see his lips turning blue. So at least the temperatures will be in our favor. Earlier in today's Fast Fact with MTN Business, I asked you about France. France's richest man. His name is Bernard Arnault. What is he seeking to combine? Now, usually a whole fistful of you come through with answers for me and give me some really good idea. But finally, I think I've caught you. Finally, I think I've got one up on you, which is good. Bernard Arnault, France's richest man. He is the chief executive of the luxury goods group LVMH. He's looking to combine the maker of Louis Vuitton luggage and Moët Champagne with the fashion house Christian Dior. He happens also to be the main shareholder at Christian Dior, and he's proposing a complex deal to buy out the rest of the shares in that particular company. And the move today being widely welcomed by investors, the question is whether or not the fashionistas, upon whom these companies' profits depend, will stay loyal to the brands. Or do people who spend that much money on clothing really care who the boss is, as long as all the stuff is cool, funky, and trendy, and very, very expensive, and that way your friends think you're terribly rich for wearing it? Maybe that's the case. But yeah, Bernard Arnault is looking to combine LVMH and Christian Dior. That's today's Fast Fact, courtesy of MTN Business. And here's some fast facts about MTN Business. They're the ICT provider with end-to-end security solutions, which means they'll do vulnerability assessments, they'll look at email security, mobile device security, firewalls, even IT network security, the whole bang shoot to make sure that you protect your business. And to do so, you can visit mtnbusiness.com/ZA. If you know your fast facts, remember, join us for the MTN Biz Quiz on Friday, where if you are the whiz of the Brutal Biz Quiz, you'll win 2,000 Rand in cash.
The Money Show on your number one news and talk station.
The Money Show, brought to you by the Old Mutual Investment Group. Invest where the fund managers invest. Welcome to The Money Show on this Tuesday evening. Next time on The Money Show, Dr. Cheryl Calder, the founder of a South African business called iGym. She is our shapeshifter. She's developed iGym. She's a leading sports scientist, a performance coach, and she helps teams perform better by improving their reaction times, by making sure that they're more agile, by making sure that their eyes days, work smarter. And she's taking the world by storm, South African innovator Dr. Cheryl Calder, the founder of iGym, next time on The Money Show.
The financial views and insights from the Berkshire Hathaway AGM are brought to you by The Wealth Experts.
Krista Kluck is Head of Innovation and Solutions at Standard Bank Wealth. And we're going, I wanted to say, on a summer holiday, because that's a funky tune, but we'll be in trouble if we class it as a holiday. We're going to work very, very hard, you and I, as we go to Omaha, Nebraska. Did you hear the weather forecast? It's going to be quite nice. High teens, at least, next week.
That sounds great, Bruce. And thanks for doing your homework on that. And looking forward to some good weather.
You know, exactly, because it can be pretty miserable in the middle of America at this time of the year. I think it's pretty hit and miss. This week's pretty grim, and then sort of warming up really nicely after we leave. But we're going to the Berkshire Hathaway annual general meeting. This is where two old men sit on a stage in a room of 30,000 people and talk for 7 hours. Now, I don't know about you, but to my uneducated ear, that doesn't sound enticing. But you're more excited than a kid in the candy store, I think.
Absolutely, Bruce. I think this year will be a very interesting AGM. I mean, it's not only is the weather good, but the markets are performing very well. And I think this year, as opposed to previous years, Berkshire Hathaway have made a number of good investments. And they're very bullish on the market. So I'm keen to hear what Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger have to say.
Warren Buffett, of course, is the younger of the two. He's 87
later this year, yes.
And Charlie Munger is
93 later this year.
And these guys have been working together for a long time. They've built Berkshire Hathaway from zero to one of the biggest investment companies in the world. It's made Warren Buffett one of the richest. Along his side, he's made Bill Gates the richest men in the world. They've given a lot of money away to charity. But at the core, they are old-fashioned investors. They buy cheap, they hold on for as long as possible, they harvest dividends, and at some point they do sell the shares that they invest in when the time is right. And they get it right more often than they get it wrong.
They certainly do, Bruce. And I think it's worth noting that you have a diversified holding across the U.S. economy. I think that's quite important to note there. Some sectors perform well, like technology. Others might not, like the reinsurance market, which has been under some pressure. So, but yes, they're long-term investment players, and they back themselves.
I mean, are you a big follower?
Yes, Bruce. So you can't be in the investments industry and not have studied Buffett and his renowned economist Benjamin Graham that he's taken his learnings from. There's a lot to learn from them.
Okay, so it's good old-fashioned investment values, good old-fashioned investment guidance. Why go all the way to America to sit in a room full of predominantly senior citizens, who many of whom have made many, many millions of dollars over the years by simply having faith in the most diversified investment group in the world?
So Warren Buffett, I think from his AGM sessions, you get a lot of insights, Bruce. So he regards it more as a family function, and you'll see when we get there that it's very much a capitalist kind of place that they'll visit, and we'll go into his shopping center that he has alongside his AGM. We're promoting a lot of their products. But the learnings, I think, there are very critical. And it's a good time of the year to reflect on the lessons from Warren Buffett's approach to investing, who has been the most successful long-term investor that we have today.
What are you hoping to take away from it?
So Bruce, yes, that's very interesting. They've invested in an online insurance company some time back called Geico, a wholly owned subsidiary of theirs. And Berkshire are very bullish on the insurance market sales and how that moves, moving in the internet space. But I'm keen to hear to see whether that's really happening in the U.S. and are online sales and service of retail insurance products really getting the traction that they seem to say they are.
My impression of U.S. financial services is it's more antiquated. I use that term reservedly, of course, advisedly, than perhaps ours. Are they sort of catching up with the 21st century? You've seen the emergence of the assurances of the world and many others in the insurance space. The Americans seem to be playing catch up in some
respects. Certainly, Bruce. And I think that's one of the areas. The other area is in renewable energy. So Warren Buffett has gone on record in saying that they'll be investing up to $30 billion in renewable energies, and they have their Berkshire Hathaway energy business, and in which they've already invested $12 billion, and it will be interesting to hear how that's progressing.
This is a guy who's a big investor in Coca-Cola, whose favorite meal is a Coca-Cola and a hamburger.
Indeed.
He's barely going to be an advert for Tim Noakes and any of the sort of low-carb, banting sort of lifestyle benefits that are promoted by somebody like Tim Noakes and others who are followers of that particular fad. But Warren Buffett is going strong. It looks like he's in for the long haul still.
He certainly is. He certainly is, Bruce. And I wanted to pick up on a piece that that Warren wrote in one of his famed letters. And I don't know if you had an opportunity to read through them, but this one was written in 1994, and I thought you would find it quite interesting.
Yes.
It says that their investing approach is they continue to ignore political and economic forecasts. They're an expensive distraction for many investors and businessmen. 30 years ago, and this is now speaking as Warren Buffett, no one could have foreseen the huge expansion of the Vietnam War, two oil shocks, the resignation of a president, or T-bills fluctuating between 2.8% and 17.4%. He said he finished, but was surprised. None of these blockbuster events made the slightest dent in our investment principles. Imagine the cost to us then if we had let a fear of unknowns cause us to defer or alter the deployment of capital. So he finished with, fear is the foe of the faddist, but the friend of the fundamentalist. And I think that's really important for us to remember in these times, Bruce.
I can't wait to see whether or not he's sticking to those principles in Trump's America. This time last year, Barack Obama was the president of the U.S. It was widely expected that Hillary Clinton would be president right now. That game has changed, and we'll bring those lessons, you and I, back from the United States, and we'll see whether or not those principles are valid here. And I suspect, as a student of history myself, I suspect that if you've ignored short-term noise in South Africa over the same period as Warren Buffett has made his billions, you would have done okay in South Africa even.
Absolutely. Bruce, since 1925, you would know this as well, is that the JSE's returned an average of 14.6% per annum through many turbulent periods. So, sticking to our well-advised financial plans is more important in challenging times than it is in good times. And I think that's something we should reflect on at this stage in SA's juncture and internationally.
I'm hyper excited to go and to join you, Chris Clack, next week.
Wonderful.
In Omaha, Nebraska, where we will spend some time, quality time, listening to the wisdom of two of the most experienced investors in the world, and hopefully bring back the lessons from Omaha, Nebraska that are relevant to us here in South Africa. Krista Clark, thank you very much. The head of innovation and solutions at Standard Bank Wealth.
The Money Show. Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
But some quite terrifying warnings today that the SABC is so short of cash it might not be able to pay salaries. Tandi Smith is head of policy and at Media Monitoring Africa. How much certainty is there in the cash flow situation of the SABC, Tandi?
Hi. I think that there is this massive cloud of uncertainty around the cash flow figures. What we do know is that we are seeing a corporation that is in grave financial crisis. And this isn't something, that sprung out of nowhere. We've known about the financial issues for a while now. So I don't think we can say that they definitely will get paid or won't get paid at the end of the month.
I mean, there are warnings coming from the board at the SABC and sources within the SABC board suggesting that there's some very real concerns. Tladi Motseneng's 90% local music quota, local content quota, cost the broadcaster more than 200 million rand. This is what the board told us yesterday, and they're still trying to piece together just how big the mess they've inherited is.
Yeah, I think, that's not the only, one of the only flags that have come up as a major issue. We've seen issues of corruption and financial mismanagement across various different departments. I mean, if you look at just the top senior management of the SABC, 22 senior managers, having a total of around 43 million rand in expenditure annually. We see this in the latest financial reports from last year. 15 of those who are receiving, more than 2 million rand in annual salaries. And so, yes, we can attribute it to various issues, including the local content issue, which is, a very serious one as well. But there are cases of mismanagement across the board.
One is an expenditure issue and one is a revenue issue. And certainly SABC revenues have been affected. Audience numbers have been affected. Tladi Motseneng signing himself as the hero, the savior of the SABC. What the new board is telling us is nothing could be further from the truth.
Yeah, we would completely agree with that. It's we've been flagging these issues for years now. And again, this is something that we have seen before. We'll look at the 2008-2009 financial crisis, where then we were also seeing local content, well, producers and content creators not getting paid. And we find ourselves again in the situation. And, you know, we have seen Claudia Motsoeneng making really bizarre, disastrous decisions around SABC for over the past year that have all contributed to the situation.
Yep, and yeah, it's the deputy chairperson of the board who's been telling Eyewitness News today, Thandi Smith, thank you very much, head of policy at Media Monitoring Africa, telling Eyewitness News today, telling Gay Davis that, yep, the SABC is in a position where it may not have enough money to pay salaries this month. And if that's the case, the problem is far bigger than anybody had feared. We watch it very, very closely indeed. The Money Show brought to you by the Old Mutual Investment Group. Invest where the fund managers invest. It's 7 minutes past seven on this Tuesday night. Still to come in the next hour, the science of the rental deal. We'll talk about the growing prevalence of rentals in South Africa as a means to have a roof over your head, whether you're a backyard dweller and somebody has built a shelter for you to stay in and you pay them some money to do so, whether you rent a one-bed apartment or you rent something considerably better than you would be able to afford to buy and you're paying off somebody else's bond. But there's a lot of technological innovation in this particular world of rentals. And so it's designed to make it more efficient. It's designed to make it easier. It's designed to make it quicker. It's designed to make you as the owner's life easier and more certain in terms of the credibility of the tenant that you get. Because in South Africa, the horror stories are legion of people who rent out properties. And I've seen this happen personally before, where the tenant stops paying or the tenant refuses to come to stick to the T's and C's and the contract that you have with them. And then in order to remove that particular individual from the property concerned, you need to get mean and you need to go to the High Court, and that costs tens of thousands of rand, which kind of takes away any kind of incentive to be a rental, to be a landlord. So let's talk about that coming up later on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
How is Andy Rice this evening, our branding and advertising expert? Feeling chipper, feeling good, feeling grumpy? I like it when you're grumpy. Feeling grumpy? Good, good.
Fit as a fiddle, Bruce. Fit as a fiddle.
Oh, dear. It's going to be a tame one tonight. Then, now, listen, let's start with heroes in that case, if you're feeling in a good mood. Maserati. You were going to pick a fight with Maserati.
Well,
then
absolutely.
You took a step back.
This is one of those ones where first impressions let you down. Now, I had seen Maserati advertising their Levante SUV very evocatively on television with a nice little line that I think says, you know, the Maserati of SUVs. And I know it's a brand that you're very familiar with, Bruce, but it's kind of out of my league. And I thought to myself, why are they using mass media, expensive production, to reach a very, very niche market? Because I assumed only a handful of these things would find buyers in South Africa every year. So armed with what I thought was going to be a zero, I contacted the marketing director, Jason Cleghorn, and he put me to rights because basically most of the assumptions I'd made turned out to be incorrect. And while this may not be a full-blown hero, it's certainly, at the very least, a rehabilitated zero. So what were the things I discovered? Well, firstly, I discovered that they're going to sell more of them than I thought. I mean, you have to sort of divide your marketing budget by the number of cars you expect to sell to see if you're getting any return on investment. And to my surprise, they're targeting 120 per annum, not a lot in Volkswagen terms or other brands, but I think quite a lot for this particular priced model. 10 a month, not bad at all. So that was the first thing that surprised me. The second thing was that they can choose their media in quite a narrow and cost-effective way. So this is a car, apparently, that will be driven mainly by affluent women. And there are women's packages available on DSTV, which narrow down from the very broad audience to the much more specialist audience of affluent women, particularly black women. So that more sense, less media wastage. Then I discovered that, in fact, what they're really trying to do also is just to get footfall, get people into their showrooms, because they may then not so much buy a Levante, but perhaps look lovingly at a Quattroporte or one of the other vehicles that the Maserati offer. So that helps as well. And finally, I discovered that the production cost of these glorious television commercials is negligible, or in fact almost nothing, to local Maserati team, because they're shot for other markets and kind of loaned to South Africa. So all in all, I went from thinking how wasteful in media terms and in production terms and in audience terms to thinking, actually, that makes a lot of sense.
Okay, so not even a reluctant hero, perhaps one that went from zero to hero in Andy's mind. The Maserati ads on TV, I don't know, they sold 10 a month. That's not a bad sales record for a pricey car in the South African market, sports models. And I also learned a lot from that, Andy, in terms of the target audience is women, which again is, to my mind anyway, and please, if you're a woman who drives a Maserati, I'd be very, very keen to hear from you as to what the appeal is. I was listening to a podcast, an American podcast, the other day about the success of Subaru in the United States and how the Subaru in the United States had targeted one of the particular models toward the lesbian market. And highly affluent individuals, very active, lots of lifestyle aspects to the way in which this particular target market would live, lots of outdoorsy activities. And Subaru did it brilliantly in the United States. So these niche marketing activities, Andy, seem to be very successful.
They are, provided you've got the media channels to reach them. Because it's one thing to say, here is a segment I would like to sell my brand to. But it's no use if there aren't relatively efficient media channels with which to reach them. So Maserati have gone on to use ENCA and CNBC to promote the Quattroporte, because that's, again, an efficient way of getting to top businessmen.
Interesting. Okay, Andy Rice, that's our hero, the Maserati ads on TV and the way Maserati has successfully segmented the market in order to have maximum bang for their buck. What about brand names? These ideas that people have and think, oh, that'll make a funky name. Nobody will forget that name. You want to pick a fight with one in particular?
Well, perhaps even more than one. I mean, what's in a name? Have you heard that phrase before? A rose by any other name would smell as sweet. Now, Mr. Shakespeare and I would disagree, because I think that brand names are very important, particularly for first impressions. They tell you a lot about what to expect, and in many instances, they attract or deter you from looking further. We spoke some time ago about lovely brands like I Can't Believe It Isn't Butter, which was then trumped, in my view, by the competitor who came up with Utterly Butterly.
Yes.
Now, those brand names instantly draw you in, and I've got a couple that actually I found less attractive. So in the financial services category, obviously a lot of us sometimes get into trouble with debt and worry about the way things are going, and there are niche operators who come along and help you out. And one that's been advertising a lot on television lately is called Debt Busters. Now, you might argue that that's a very descriptive and efficient brand name, but for me, there's a reason why financial services brands have always been very mature, very sober, very institutional, because it's money that we're playing with here, and it's debt that you're trying to get out of, so you want people who are very serious. And I think this kind of slightly frivolous name works terrifically in some categories, but doesn't work so well in the financial services category. So I think that's the wrong kind of tone to set from the outset if you're talking to someone who really has got themselves into big financial trouble.
I mean, again, slightly on the personal edge, Andy, but have you ever been in deep financial trouble? Do you know at that particular point what appeals to somebody who is with their back against the wall?
Well, as someone trying desperately to get his net assets up to zero, I'm not sure whether I'm qualified to answer that, but I can imagine it is very, very distressing. And perhaps for a sector of the market, you know, a good, hard-hitting, clear name like Debt Busters is right, but for me, it just doesn't quite got the sense of institutional solidity that I think you need in this sector.
But I mean, financial services companies, and sorry to harp on about this, Andy, but I mean, Prudential had an online bank called Egg, for goodness sake.
Yes.
What's in a name?
Well, I agree. I mean, there's always exceptions that prove the rule, but most major financial services institutions are on the side of sedate, sensible, down-to-earth kind of stuff. And this one, for me, I feel is inappropriate from a personality point of view.
Okay, frivolous. Too frivolous for Andy.
Yep. And then there was another one. You want to hear another one?
I do, actually. I mean, and it's also, I mean, so often people with unfortunate names name their unfortunate companies after themselves.
Well, that's what I thought in this particular case, but when I went onto their website, I could find no evidence of that. If it's true, then I would be delighted to be corrected. But what to you, Bruce, is a blackhead?
It's a nasty, pimply skin blemish that afflicts predominantly teenagers.
Well, absolutely. And unless you're called Bruce Blackhead, you would probably not think instantly that makes a great name for a consultancy.
And you wonder what the origins of the name are. We know what the origins of the Carpenters and the Thatcher family.
Exactly,
where would the Blackhead family have got their name from?
Particularly since it is a consulting business, as far as I can see. This is called Blackhead Consulting, by the way. And I just saw a sign on a building saying Blackhead Consulting, and I thought that can't be right. There must be a Mr. Blackhead. But no, doesn't seem to be the case. And particularly if you're consultants, where as a category, and I'm one, we're often seen as, well, pimples on an otherwise unblemished skin. You know, consultants don't really have a very good reputation. So I would be looking for a name that was a little more positive and a little bit more healthy, shall we say, than that one. But who knows?
They've been around for a long time. They've been around since 2004. They're engineering consultants.
The question is whether they might have done better still with a different name up front, that I can't answer. But it just seemed to me that if you're going to choose a name from the creative process of coming up with a brand and you get to Blackhead, is that really the end of the line? Should you not have said to yourself, let's try a couple of alternatives?
Andy Rice with Heroes and Zeros, the branding and advertising expert with his strong opinions on what makes a hero and what makes a zero. Maserati was very nearly in the zero column. He did his research and turned it from zero to hero and then went looking at brand names and thought to himself, there are better ways of branding businesses than sort of giving them names that can be pilloried or names that undermine what they're trying to achieve. So that's Andy Rice's view this evening with Heroes and Zeros.
The Money Show.
Your number one news and talk station.
There's surprisingly few taxi crashes in South Africa relative to other modes of transport, and certainly if you consider the number of taxis on the road, as a percentage of vehicles, they have relatively few accidents. The data supports that. But when they crash, there can be very, very serious consequences for those on board. The lack of seatbelts, overcrowding, they contribute largely to the death tolls and to the injury tolls when accidents do happen. Another crash today in KZN. 16 preschool kids injured just days after a horror crash near Bronkhorstspruit, in which 20 school children were killed. And it's interesting that social media's response today by somebody who goes by the name of Wills74, saying if one person is injured or is killed in the mining industry, authorities shut it down. Why is it that the taxi industry is not equally regulated? I found that an interesting comment, and I thank you, Will74, for that particular remark. If only we knew the answer to that particular question.
The Money Show.
The Africa Business Report.
Lee Kasumba, Africa Business News correspondent, on the line to us from Joburg this evening. Lee, the Somali pirates are re-emerging. It's been a while since we heard of a big attack off East Africa.
Yes, it has been, Bruce. It's been about 4 years. And recently, the U.S. Defense Secretary visited Djibouti, where one of America's largest naval bases is centered. And that's obviously right next to Yemen and Somalia. And during the press conference, the Marine General of that particular base mentioned about how they've had half a dozen incidents, is what he called it. I don't think he wanted to, you know, go out there and say it was an actual trend so that they wouldn't, you know, spark a lot of worry. And so basically there were half a dozen incidences. And in the last 2 months alone, two UAE commercial ships have been hijacked in the last 2 months alone. So it is something that is obviously, I mean, it affects. We remember last time it was quite a big story last time round. And I guess this time round, the reason, you know, a lot of people are perhaps a little bit more sensitive around the issue because, as you know, Somalia is facing a famine. Like, you know, the UN is declaring Somalia a famine area, and 6.2 million people do actually need food desperately. So the pirates are kind of, on one hand, being seen as the people who are trying to find a way for the day-to-day survival. But if these hijackings and, you know, this piracy continues with these big commercial ships, what's going to happen is it's obviously going to affect the little bit of money that the country is able to generate, you know, from people using their ports. So it's a catch-22 situation.
Do we still know whether or not big governments have still got significant resources in the oceans off East Africa or off in the Indian Ocean, whether the patrols are still as intense as they were 3 or 4 years ago? Or have those patrols contributed to a decline in piracy, and as a result of a decline in piracy, there are fewer patrols, and when there are fewer patrols, there's an increase in piracy?
It's exactly the latter, you know, because of the patrols, there's been a decline in piracy and obviously a lack of patrol, you know, decline in patrols. But basically the intelligence officers in Somalia are working with the U.S. Marines to kind of up the patrolling of those oceans just to ensure that it doesn't kind of blow out of, you know, out of proportion.
Now, for those of us who in South Africa, we're very familiar with, say, ShopRite or Checkers, Pick and Pay with Woolies and Spar. If you live in East Africa, you're going to be more familiar with Nakumat than any other other retailer. Nakumat's a family business, is it?
Yes, Nakumat is a family business. It's quite iconic within the East Africa region, but more specifically in Kenya. And they have 63 stores, you know, and part of the reason why the family business was able to grow was generally in terms of Kenya's retail sector, they were able, you know, the people were quite conservative and they were able to resist global trends. So when Walmart tried to come into Kenya, basically, they were able to stand head and shoulders, you know, above Walmart, and they entered the market through the South African subsidiary Massmart. But in the last 2 years or so, or possibly a bit more, I mean, now everybody's getting a bit more wind, Nakumat and other family supermarkets like Tuskys are suffering quite a bit, obviously because of the, you know, the entire global economic situation, but then, you know, they have the elections coming up, and then they also have, like, obviously a lack of foot traffic going in. But one of the biggest things that's just come out is the fact that they are not able to pay the suppliers. So, you know, their debt to the suppliers, the people who supply to Nakumat, is sitting at about 18 billion shillings, which is quite a lot. And some of the other competitors like Tuskys have had to shut down a lot more stores than what Nakumat has had to. And currently, you know, so Nakumat is basically, they've been lucky enough to get an investor who stepped in, and they have quite a big market share within Nakumat at the moment. And it looks like they're going to be helping them, you know, ride that tide, but they're not really disclosing who the investor is, and, you know, obviously that alludes towards it possibly being an international investor, you know, in order to save that particular market.
I mean, what sort of big international companies? We know Carrefour, for example, is big in Francophone Africa. Is there a big player keen on East Africa?
Well, there have been quite a few big players that were keen. As mentioned, Walmart was really trying to go in there, you know, but they haven't really, you know, as I mentioned, they have not mentioned who the key player is. They literally have just said it's an undisclosed investor and it's a strategic decision. So when they say that, it kind of alludes to the fact that, look, this could be somebody global, because the Kenyan economy as it is not doing so well. And obviously with the elections, you know, it's highly unlikely that somebody within the region would have that amount of money to be able to help rescue the entire chain of stores, which is like 63 stores.
I wonder how big a presence ShopRite has got in Kenya. I don't know offhand, but stranger things have happened.
Stranger things have happened, yeah.
The Emir of Kano, now, seemed to be a very, very principled individual. He was fired, I think, by Goodluck Jonathan, wasn't he? He stood up against corruption, and Goodluck Jonathan didn't like his tone, fired him. Is he making a comeback?
Yeah, he's making quite a comeback. The Emir of Kano, he definitely, as you said, he's rather outspoken. He's always there to basically, you know, show the average person what exactly is going on when it comes to the numbers within Nigeria. So outside of Goodluck Jonathan, most recently with the current president, Buhari, he also kind of got into a tiff with him because Buhari has been trying to loan about $29,960 billion in order to help the Nigerian economy, which is in a hectic recession. And so the Emir of Kano obviously stood up and he was like, how is this even going to happen, you know, when Nigeria does not even have one exchange rate? Basically, there's five exchange rates for each time that that you want to exchange dollars or foreign currency in Nigeria. So that's for the petroleum, the money market, the interbank, one for the average people, you know, and one for the street market. So there are five different exchange rates, and they don't have a set reserve bank rate or a set foreign exchange rate. So he kind of highlighted that, which obviously didn't make President Buhari very happy. And now, ironically, the tables seem to be turning on him, but obviously it does look like a bit of political foul play, where in the region where he's from, which is in Kano, he's being accused of basically embezzling or squandering like quite a bit of money, you know. But he has, you know, normally in Africa, when somebody's accused of like either stealing money or anything like that, they're very quiet. But the Emir of Kano has been more than happy to allow people to look at the books. You know, his entire team has come out in full force. They're like, these are the books. This is what was spent. This is actually how much it is that we got. And it's also important to note that, you know, he did stop the building of mosques within that region, and he wanted to build more schools to educate the girls, you know, because he's of Muslim Islamic descent and everything. So it looks like it's gonna be him against the Nigerian government, and he kind of won last year in terms of getting, I mean, the last time with the last president, in terms of getting, you know, people around the world to really see, you know, what was happening. So we'll see what happens with President Buhari and Emir of Kano. I'm going to watch that like a soap opera, to be very honest.
But is it the sort of soap opera that Lee ends up with the Emir of Kano dead, or the next president of Nigeria?
No, I don't. It wouldn't go to that level. I think, you know, for a number of reasons. Firstly, both of them are Muslim. And so there is like in Nigeria, there is a huge respect when you're from the same kind of religious background and tradition. I think it's going to be a soap opera that's going to be more a war of words, because Buhari doesn't speak as often as he should, but the Emir of Kano is quite, you know, he's quite good with his words. He sends out press releases. He's got an entire team. So I think it'll play out in public, in the public eye, if that makes sense. And it'll play out in press, in media. And the Emir of Kano does do quite a lot of talk around the world about the Nigerian economy. So I think in that perspective, I don't anticipate it'll become anything dangerous. It just looks like it'll be a clash of possibly egos and who was right and who actually knows what's going on, because the Emir of Kano is the former governor of the Central Bank of Nigeria. He was also once, I think like maybe 3 years ago, he was named one of Forbes' most, you know, influential Africans. And he's quite a smart guy when it comes to numbers. He's really smart. So I think it's just one of those situations, yeah.
Well, you better invest in some popcorn then, Lee Kasumba. Thank you, Africa Business News correspondent Lee Kasumba, on the line to us from Joburg.
702 and Cape Talk, The Money Show.
Welcome to The Money Show. It's just 26 minutes to 8. Any questions on rentals, property rentals, and if you're feeling hard done by because your landlord is unreasonable, or if you're feeling hard done by because your tenants are unreasonable, and you're looking for some guidance from Justin Melville this evening, the co-founder and chief executive at Ekaya.com. We briefly chatted to Justin Melville a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about a Cape Town phenomenon called aversion. It's four letters, starts with an F, and I called it foul up nights. It's an event in Cape Town where entrepreneurs meet. They talk about the mistakes that they've made in a way that helps prevent others from doing the same thing wrong themselves. So it's a very therapeutic process, but he whetted my appetite to learn more. So Justin Melville, co-founder and chief executive of Ekaya.com. You tried your hand at the music industry. You tried to change the music industry from a flat in Cape Town, and you decided that's a mug's game. So you went into the property rental industry instead. And many people think that's a mug's game, isn't it?
Well, I think historically it has been. I think what we see in music or property has always been the opportunity to actually, you know, bring a combination of some creative thinking, some good technology, and then try and make it so it's not a mug's game, really. Try and create a way for people to interact in a more predictable and efficient way.
Are you a technologist, or do you have a legal background? You're a designer. Yeah. So you have no legal background.
Well, I took a couple of semesters of law in university, and I've had to write an awful lot of my own contracts to save a bit of cash on the side. But yeah, I'm actually one of the creative types.
Okay, so you're a creative type going into the property rental industry. Mm. Tell me about the state of the rental industry, because anecdotally, in a world where you don't need to own a car anymore, courtesy of Uber, you don't need to own a holiday house because you've got Airbnb and you can go and stay in other people's houses. Do you really need to own a house anymore?
I think the bigger question is, are you going to be able to own a house?
Are you capable of saving up the deposit to put down and then, of course, fund the transfer duties and the bank repayments and the repairs and maintenance and all of those terrible things?
Sure. So there's a few factors that are worth bearing in mind when you think about renting, is that thanks to some men in suits in 2008, fewer people will be able to afford to buy homes. Some say the millennials will never be able to buy homes. As a millennial myself, I feel that.
Yeah.
Secondly, I mean, you've got this trend of urbanization, just people moving into cities, which creates a housing shortage. And the third thing is, I think actually people are looking for different things out of their life. Like, do we actually want to own a home, or do we want mobility? Do we want, is our home just like a function of our lifestyle at this particular stage in time? So it's a combination of sort of economic pressures and like personal choice and just the generational shift in mindset, again, towards this more sort of sharing economy that you alluded to earlier.
I mean, there's a very strong school of thought that says you can afford to rent considerably better than you can afford to own. And if you're not, if you're prepared to cut back on your lifestyle expectations and you can rent slightly below where you would like to, I don't know, it's better spending $5,000, spend $4,500 and take the extra $500 and put that into investments. And so you're not simply pouring money down a bottomless pit of a rental agreement, but actually there's an investment component on the side of it as well. So you're doing yourself a favor with not having the upfront costs of owning property and the maintenance costs and the levies and all of the hassle that comes with owning property. But as long as you do it modestly, you should have cash left over to actually make some investments on the side.
Or travel, if that's what you're into.
Yeah, millennials. Oh,
I know, right?
Or have a life. or have a life. So those are the trends that you're capitalizing on there.
Yeah, well, it's the environment that when we began Akaya that we saw was happening all around the world. And I guess that's the fact that it's become such a competitive environment and it's evolving quickly, but the fact that the means of addressing it or working within it has not changed much since, the late 90s, really. I mean, to give you a perfect example, where most people will go to find an apartment is a place like Gumtree or OLX, a classified site. Like, how high tech is that? we're seeing a shift to Facebook and whatever, but it's just an example of how no one has really looked at this industry. It's for years, real estate's all about being for sale and investment and return and all that kind of stuff. It's kind of been like an abandoned appendage of the greater real estate space.
Sure. I mean, again, one looks and you focused, I'm assuming, exclusively on Cape Town at this stage. You're fairly new.
We actually are fully national.
Fully national.
We've got some customers in Swaziland too.
Fully. When you say fully national, you've got what, one property each in Joburg and Bloemfontein and 10 in Cape Town? Or
no, look, Joburg and Cape Town are obviously just by population, going to be the biggest ones. But it's also where renting is more, like I said, the access to property, whether you're buying or renting, is pretty scarce. So those two places are definitely where activities are concentrated. But I'll give you something that I probably didn't know up until quite recently when the mines all imploded. It was Limpopo had the highest amount of new rentals every single year, the highest average rent every single year, and the highest increase on those rentals every single year.
What were the dynamics that were fueling that?
Well, look, I don't understand too much about it, but as I understand, there's some large industrial activity that was going on up there. I think it was mining.
Yeah.
And that's recently come to an end, and so has the housing boom. But basically, there was a rush to buy and put up often quite cheap housing for the workforce that came in. I mean, everyone from senior management to the guys actually working at the coalface, as it were. And it's just an example of how in a very, there was a flash of activity there. And you would think Cape Town would be the highest rent, but no, it was Limpopo by almost 20%.
It's extraordinary, isn't
it's
it?
It's weird, right?
No, but those are the dynamics that when you're working with real data and real data sets rather than intuition, you get to learn about. How many properties in your books then?
We have just a shade under 4,000 properties.
That's a lot of property.
Well, we reckon there's probably about 2 million out there, so we've still got a long way to go. But, it's enough for us to have seen some stuff on both sides of the coin.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who's ever rented a property knows that you are treated like a third-class citizen. You really are, and you go to a landlord, and you get told, your first question is, have you got a job? to prove your income, not would you like to stay in my beautiful property. How do you work your model in terms of ensuring that the owners of the properties are happy to let those properties to the customers you bring them as tenants?
So I guess there's two sides of a market, right? There's the professionally managed space, rental agents, and then there's kind of the private landlord. If we're talking about the private landlord, which I believe was similar to your experience, like here's the thing, right? You have a property and you put it online and you're going to get 50 to 100 emails, texts, WhatsApps, spiritual connections, whatever method of communication a tenant can get at you.
I've now worked out where I went wrong.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's all about the spiritual connection.
Exactly.
You're going to get bombarded by effectively random strangers from the internet.
Yeah.
And what, do you want to put 50 of them through your house on a viewing or whatever? So what was lacking and kind of where we saw the opportunity to add some immediate value was the fact of how do you actually tell, how do you turn random strangers into, you know, potential candidates? And part of that, traditionally what you'd have to do, it sucks for a tenant as well, by the way, you'd have to go verify your ID, print out your bank statements, submit yourself for a credit check and probably a strip search as well. But basically, you're walking around and handing other random strangers the ingredients for identity theft. So for a tenant, it's not great either, by the way. But you're doing this time after time after time, and you pretty much have to arrive with your kidney in a cooler box for the deposit in order to land it right then and there, because there are 20 people standing right next to you ready to take this place right now. So we tried to build something that was a way for, like, at that online marketing stage, for the sake, okay, cool, this tenant, like, this is what he does earn empirically, like, through direct data, not his opinion, not what he says he earns, like, his actual data. Try and find out stuff about his payment history. Like, a credit report is, like, it's an indicator of payment history. That's what we're interested in, is how regularly do you pay the bills? How responsible are you? And we just try and make sure that you are who you say you are. And we try and blend, like, match that with a guy who's got a property and say, look, here is the data. Like, here's a view of this person. Make your decision. It's a fee. Like, we try and leave it so it really comes down to the heart at the end of the day.
Traditionally, yeah, but the heart is a dangerous thing. Traditionally, rental agents also charge an extraordinary amount of money up front. They might take the first month's rent. They may take the first 6 weeks of rent for their hard work in finding a tenant. Now, if there is so much demand for rental property, that suggests that tenants are falling over themselves for a limited number of properties. So it's not particularly hard to find a tenant. Sure, you've got to go through some admin, but if you can automate that process to a large degree and get and separate the wheat from the rental chaff, well, then if you're presenting only qualified candidates, so instead of 100 people coming through the door, the property owner has two or three to consider, well, you've made their life easier. You've also made it more likely for the great candidates to get the properties they want.
Yeah, that is, I guess, a byproduct of what our service does, which, look, at the end of the day, there are bad tenants out there, as I'm sure you've had some personal experience with. And I guess through the transparency of technology and having a more closer connection, like, between the various parties, we're hoping that the behavior will change so that people will actually realize they can't just screw the landlord and move on into anonymity and rent again happily at the end of the day. The fact that what you do, like, renting is a relationship, and that's why I say the heart kind of does play a role. You need to be able to have a conversation with one another, because sometimes life doesn't go according to plan, and you need to be able to work it out.
Sure.
Like, data only gets you so far. And I think, like, when it comes to, like, the rental relationship, yeah, as I say, life happens. You need to be able to work it out. And that's, like, that's the human component. So we bring, like, the technology to help sort of, you know, get the signal out of the noise, as it were. But at the end of the day, we try and create an environment where both parties are equal. Their reputations are both at stake. Like, if you're a slumlord as well, your reputation should follow you around. The next tenant should not have to, should know that about you. And I think, you know what they say, like, people behave better when they know they're being watched. There's an element of what we're trying to do here.
This is getting all very big brothery.
It's a reputation business, man. Or at least we'd like to bring some reputation to it. We think that'll help.
Justin Melville is the co-founder, chief executive at Ekaya. Ekaya.com. Have you used Ekaya.com either as a landlord or as a tenant? Are you familiar with what they do? Are you somebody who's got a question on the relationship between landlord and tenant from either position? Justin Melville is a designer, but he's a designer with some fairly intense property experience, 4,000 properties on his books. Happy landlords, happy tenants. No doubt there'd be a grumpy tenant or two, and maybe even a grumpy landlord, but that's the world of business, unfortunately. We talked to him about how this process works. 30,000 rand grand to rent a property in Germiston, 5-bedroom house, St. Andrews. Oh, it's very posh. And then there's another one in Northgate for 5,700 rand. There's a furnished 2-bedroom apartment in the Joburg CBD for 3.5 grand. So there's a wide spread of available properties. We'll look at those in just a moment.
The Money Show.
The science of
properties admin. It really is. If you are a landlord and if you don't treat your property as a business, if you're a landlord, well, then you are going to be taken for a ride. You are going to drop the ball. You are going to let down your tenants. Your tenants are going to let you down, and you are going to lose control of that particular process. My guest this evening is Justin Melville, the co-founder and chief executive at Akaya.com. Science of the rental deal. So how do you make it idiot-proof and foolproof?
Look, renting take or no take is a system, right? It's a set of agreements, and problems really come into play most often when there's variation, particularly prone to verbal variation of said agreements. So there are a few things like putting everything in writing is one great way to avoid a foul up.
and you have standard rental agreements that you have via your website?
It's a good starting point. I think what is important is to allow for flexibility, but just to remember to encode it in writing and for there not to be a verbal contract, because that can get in, once you enter the realm of where it could be a dispute, you're heading down a dark and lonely road.
Yeah.
Similarly, something that landlords fall into all the time is you accept a cent of partial payment and you're also in for a dark and lonely road. Make it all or nothing.
Explain the risk of partial payment.
Because partial payment then introduces, I made a deal with my landlord that I'd pay off at a small amount. And as soon as the tenant has the right to say that, then whether it's tribunal or court or whatever situation, it becomes a matter of opinion and you have to prove it. You have to fight it.
So you can be the sweet landlord who says, okay, I know we charge you 1,000 rand a month for 6 months in a row. You've fallen on hard times. We like you as a tenant. You haven't trashed the place. We want to have a long-term relationship with you. Pay us 500 rand for the next 2 months and let's get you back on your feet and we'll claw back over time.
Put it in writing.
It's
the best way to do it. As I say, just remember that when there are people who have genuine problems, but there are people who also try to take you for a ride. And the best thing you can do as like the landlord is to really set yourself up to where there can be no argument. When you have no argument, you can have anyone out of your house in 14 to 28 days.
How?
Well, for one thing, you can give them notice immediately. If you haven't accepted partial payment, because they become in breach of contract, I guess, at the end of the day.
And 14 to 28 days, so you put them on notice.
Depends if you've got a professional handling it, 28.
They ignore your notice, and 28 days later, they're still in the house. And they make sure that there's always somebody in the house so you can't go in and change the locks, because it would be illegal for you to change the locks.
Yeah,
because
any of that.
Because
this person
is still occupying your property.
Yeah. Now, the best thing is to use like the sheriff of the court to exercise this.
Need a court order to exercise it. And a court order, you've got to go to the High Court. You've got to hire.
Or
you've
got to know somebody.
But you've got to hire legal professionals in order to do this. And this goes into the realms of tens of thousands of rand.
Yeah. Look, we know lots of landlords who perhaps take this quite seriously, and they've actually been quite successful on their own. But there are actually plenty of businesses, and if you're completely kind of hands off, there's actually companies that will not only guarantee your rental on behalf of the tenant, and they'll collect from the tenant, but they also have all the inroads they need to be able to exercise.
Fair enough. But then for somebody who's got somebody who's got a marginal rental arrangement, they've overpaid for a property and they've actually got themselves into debt, and the only way in which they can afford to hold on to the property is to go back and live with mom and dad if they're lucky enough to have that opportunity, and to rent out this property, and they may have lost the job, whatever the case might be, and they've fallen on hard times themselves, and suddenly they need that 10,000 rand a month to serve the bond, and now there's a void, there's a problem, because the tenant has taken the mickey. And so you can't afford to hire the specialists, is my point.
Yeah, as I say, if you don't need so much of a specialist if you are clever about or smart about how you run it in the first place. Obviously, if you come across the really hideous stories you hear are generally quite the minority from what we see, to be honest with you.
Now, I mean, what have you learned in the process of being landlord to the landlords, if you like, to hosting the websites? I mean, do you have a different opinion of human nature today than to what you did a couple of years ago?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think the one thing is that everyone hears about the landlord's misery, but I guess we've learned that the tenants have an equal, they risk so many scams just trying to find properties. And I guess, as I say, the truth that we that sort of guides our business now is that it is a people-based business. So we look more towards how does Facebook govern, obviously not fake news, but like political disagreements or whatever. How do relationship networks actually handle? And we try to apply those principles to this real estate space. How do we create mediation? How do we create leverage for the wronged party? How do we make smarter tools available to them so that the landlord can push a button and notice it, or doesn't even have to push a button? As soon as rent isn't paid, notices are sent, applications are filed.
So give me a sense of it. I am a landlord and I've got a property, I've got a tenant. It's the first of the month, they haven't paid their rent on the 31st of last month. What would happen through your technology?
Yeah, well, first thing we do is try to help you find a good tenant in the first place.
You know, but they were a great tenant, and they had a tough break, and things went wrong.
Yeah, so the minute it doesn't arrive in, the system sends a polite, but our chain of systems send a polite but legally binding letter of notice, like you are now late, you are now in breach of this clause of that section of the lease or whatever it is, and that satisfies the compliance aspect of initiating proceedings. So it leaves the door open for resolution, but at the end of the day, you've begun that process as soon as it happens, and that's like the best thing you can do. The problem is if you wait another 28 days, then you're literally a month in the hole.
Yep.
If you act immediately,
what do you charge for the service relative to the old-fashioned rental agent who sits with a clipboard and bits of paper and takes the month or 6 weeks rental?
Look, so we actually work with rental agencies as well. Like, our goal is to build one connected platform for everybody who rents, whether they're big investors or single landlords or rental agents or tenants. Trying to build one thing that can connect all these people together, because it's about relationships and payments. Mm-hmm. That's what renting is, and we can do that. So we make majority of our money, like basically our bread and butter is a small percentage, and we're talking about 0.75% on the rentals that we process. So it's free if you don't get your money, is one way of looking at it. But it's basically a small margin. Sometimes the agents will include that into their fees. It can be moved around or whatever, but basically that's our way of getting a piece of the pie and ensuring that our success is linked.
And are you profitable on that sort of basis? At this stage, very few startups
are. If we stopped blooming growing, we'd be profitable.
It's a wonderful problem
to
have.
Software engineers are expensive, man. Yeah.
But you've got to keep writing the software to incorporate new properties on board, and as you become more successful and your tentacles reach further, you have to keep adding capacity, you keep having to add properties, and that then delays the profitability of your business. You're a typical tech startup.
Yeah, well, for us, growth is a stronger indicator of vitality than profitability at this stage. I mean, you don't want to be burning a hole in the floor, but at the end of the day, if you're just content being profitable, like, who's going to be interested?
Right? Whose money are you spending?
Well, I spent all my own along the way. But we have investors, one of which is actually a major player in real estate. And then we have a range of very well experienced, like, tech and finance entrepreneurs who've obviously on a slightly smaller scale, but
aren't you then potentially conflicted by having a big real estate player as a major shareholder?
It's sort of, again, it's the science of the deal at the end of the day. Everything in life is a negotiation. I just make sure that as an entrepreneur, I just sort of say, like, look, this is the way we work. This is how it's going to be. Like, if that's not okay with you, that's totally cool, but we probably shouldn't work together. And
how long have they been invested?
Well, as I say, Kai's been running for about 4.5 years, so some of them date that far back. But when we've taken a more serious funding, we're now about 18 months deep into that relationship.
And it's
and we're looking to raise more money again from more people around the outside world. It's just a question of actually trying to involve them in the picture. What they're actually doing is buying into the team. Their interests are not, they're not relevant to the business. The business has its own interests. It has a vision, has a mission, and we execute against that. And, like, they have an opportunity to park some of their spare cash inside our company and watch it grow. and like in a way that their businesses are incapable of doing. And that's, I mean, I know that's making some oversimplification, but that's how cool. You got to do it, man.
Justin Melville, co-founder and chief executive of Ikaya.com. Take a look. It's a nice website, and they seem to have an interesting business model that's working.